A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the Jerusalem gas explosion, and someone told him something that stopped him in his tracks. Israel doesn't actually have a centralized natural gas grid, just a disconnected series of compressed tanks and delivery pipes. He points out the gas is in the news all the time, mentioned constantly as a major energy source, but the thing everyone pictures when they picture a gas network simply isn't here. Then he asked the deeper question, for countries that do have a centralized gas grid, how does it actually work? How does gas physically move? How do we keep millions of miles of pressurized explosive gas from destroying neighborhoods? And is this whole infrastructure a dying relic in the energy transition?
These are exactly the right questions, and they nest inside each other beautifully. The how it works question is the key to the safety question, which is the key to whether we're building something or dismantling something. And Daniel's framing gets at something subtle. He's not just asking about a system, he's asking about the absence of a system and what that absence reveals.
The puzzle for me is, if gas is so important to Israel's energy mix, why does the residential side look like a camping trip scaled up? You've got this massive offshore gas infrastructure, the Leviathan Field, the Tamar Field, world-class discoveries that reshaped the entire Eastern Mediterranean energy picture, and yet the domestic consumer experience is still someone hauling a propane tank up four flights of stairs.
Because Israel uses nearly all of its gas for industrial power generation. About 12 billion cubic meters a year. Most of it goes straight to power plants. The residential sector never got plumbed. The decision was made decades ago when the gas infrastructure was being built out, and the calculus was straightforward, running distribution mains to every apartment building in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Haifa is enormously expensive, and the payback period when you're starting from scratch is measured in generations, not years. In fact, I'm not certain about every municipality, but Israel's gas market is famously fragmented with no centralized public database, even of which buildings have connections. You end up with tanks on rooftops, tanks on balconies, propane cylinders tucked under stairwells. It's a patchwork.
Which makes the Jerusalem explosion a different category of story. It wasn't a grid failure. It was a failed barbecue canister or a cylinder leak. Localized, contained, tragic, but without systemic implication.
But it forces the question, if living without a grid is its own set of risks, what does a properly engineered centralized grid give you in return, and what does it take away? Because you could argue that Israel's fragmented model actually limits the blast radius of any single failure, literally. A cylinder leak affects one apartment, one stairwell. A grid overpressure event affects entire neighborhoods simultaneously. So let's start with the most basic level. How does gas actually move from a well into your kitchen?
That's the strange cognitive gap. We can picture electrons moving through copper because we have ready analogies. Water in pipes, sparks in wires, nothing visual to anchor to. It's invisible, it's odorless in its natural state, and the infrastructure that moves it is almost entirely buried. Most people have never seen a gas transmission pipe. They wouldn't recognize a compressor station if they drove past one. So there's this whole invisible geography under our feet that we depend on completely but never think about.
Here's the clean version. Natural gas doesn't get pumped the way municipal water gets pumped. It isn't sucked along by fans or pulled through the line. The entire system operates on a single physics principle. Gas flows from high pressure to low pressure, always. That's it. There's no equivalent of a water pump that creates suction on one end and pressure on the other. The gas simply moves because the universe abhors a pressure gradient and wants to equalize it.
When we say the gas grid has pressure, we don't mean the thing is pressurized for storage convenience. We mean pressure is the motor. It's not a feature of the system, it is the system. Without the pressure differential, nothing moves. The entire continent-spanning infrastructure is just a very expensive set of buried tubes.
A cubic foot of gas at point A has more molecules crammed into it than a cubic foot at point B. That differential generates flow. At the wellhead, gas emerges already under immense natural pressure, thousands of pounds per square inch, the weight of miles of rock pressing down on the reservoir. When that pressure drops over distance, compressor stations, spaced every 50 to 100 miles along transmission pipelines, boost it back up. And here's the elegant part. Those compressors are usually powered by the gas itself. A small fraction of the throughput is burned to run turbines that drive the compressors. The fuel is the cargo. The cargo propels itself.
The flow of gas is effectively paying its own conveyance. A toll road where the toll booths also consume a tiny amount of whatever you're hauling. If corn were efficiently fungible, its shipments could power their own transport.
That is a perfect economic analogy there, corn, and also strangely ahead of its time in biofuels. But think about what that means for system design. You don't need external power at these remote compressor stations. You don't need to run electrical lines out to the middle of West Texas or the Alberta Prairie. The pipeline carries its own energy source. It's an extraordinarily self-contained system, which is part of why it could be built out so rapidly in the mid-20th century, before the electrical grid reached everywhere.
More deconstructed corn banter. But I do want to pause on that self-contained quality, because it connects to something we'll get to later about the death spiral. If the system is this elegantly self-powering, you don't notice the cost of running it until the customer base starts shrinking, and the fixed costs have to be spread across fewer people. The compressors still need to run whether they're serving 1 million homes or 500,000. That's the trap.
That's exactly where we're headed. But first, let's lay out the physical architecture, because you can't understand the economics without understanding the pipes. Three-tier hierarchy. Top level, transmission pipelines. These are the big arteries. 36 to 48 inch diameter steel pipe, buried 3 to 6 feet below ground. They move gas from gathering systems near wells and carry it across states and over borders. A molecule of gas heading from the Permian Basin in West Texas to somebody's stove in Chicago will ride those transmission mains for roughly 1,200 miles.
It'll also face about 15 compressor station repressurizations on that trip. From the numbers I've seen, the typical travel time is about 3 days, end to end, which is actually faster than a lot of freight shipping when you think about it. 3 days to move a molecule from Texas to a burner in Illinois, and it never gets loaded onto a truck or a train. It just flows continuously through a dedicated conduit that exists for no other purpose.
That lines up with what I understand. And once the gas reaches the outskirts of where it'll be used, it hits a city gate station. That's where it transitions into the distribution mains, the second tier. Those are smaller pipes, 2 to 24 inches in diameter, under your street, not running under county lines. At the city gate, the utility drops the pressure dramatically and also injects mercaptan, which is the rotten egg odorant which we'll get to. But the pressure drop is the critical step. You're going from hundreds of pounds per square inch in the transmission line down to maybe 60 psi in the distribution main, and then even lower as you branch out into neighborhoods.
Which is absolutely cardinally deranged to those from outside the Anglophone centralized gas empire. Actually, probably also to people on the empire's lawns. Mercaptan is an invention so precise as to reverse engineer a skunk's grievance. The human nose can detect it at concentrations of about 1 part per billion. That's the equivalent to being able to taste a single drop of something in an Olympic swimming pool. It's an extraordinary sensory hack. We took an odorless explosive gas and gave it a smell so distinctive and so universally recognized as wrong that even people who have never been trained in gas safety will notice it immediately.
The choice of that particular smell wasn't arbitrary. They tested different odorants. And mercaptan won because it's not a smell that occurs naturally in most environments. You don't confuse it with cooking smells or garbage or anything else that might be normal in a home. It cuts through everything. It says something is wrong here at a level below conscious thought.
Then the third tier, service lines. These are a half inch to an inch in diameter. They branch off the distribution main into your home. At this point, the pressure is a fraction of a pound per square inch, essentially ambient. When you turn the knob on your stove, that tiny pressure differential pushes gas out of the burner. And here's what's wild to me. That final pressure is so low that if you put your thumb over the open end of a disconnected service line, you could stop the flow. The entire continent-spanning system. All those compressor stations and 1,000-mile transmission lines. All of it exists to deliver gas to your stove at a pressure that a human thumb can overcome.
That's by design. The low pressure at the point of use is a safety feature. You don't want high-pressure gas inside someone's kitchen. You want it to trickle out gently, mix with air, and burn cleanly. The engineering challenge is managing the enormous pressure differential between the wellhead and the burner tip. Thousands of PSI down to a quarter. PSI without anything breaking.
If the burner passes that bit about checking for flame, the balloon string of it becomes a bright, efficient, usable energy.
The volume getting delivered to that burner in most arrangements is absolutely terrifying when you think about it in total infrastructure terms. 2.4 million miles of natural gas pipeline in the United States. Circle the Earth 96 times. And that's just the distribution and transmission lines. That doesn't count the service lines to individual homes, which would add hundreds of thousands more miles. It's one of the largest engineered systems humans have ever built, and almost none of it is visible.
That is the definition of unspooling out of one's ability to make cognitive maps. 2.4 million miles of pipe, all of it pressurized, all of it carrying something explosive, and the whole thing is underground. We walk over it every day. Our children play above it. We park cars on top of it. And we almost never think about it until something goes wrong.
It all runs on differential. There is no master pump. There is a distributed heart across thousands of compressor stations. Each one is a node in a network that has no central control point. It's a system that emerged over decades as different pipeline companies built different segments and interconnected them. The result is a kind of organic, evolved infrastructure rather than something that was planned from a single blueprint, which is both its strength, its redundant and resilient in many ways, and its vulnerability, because no single entity has complete visibility into the whole thing.
So we've got a reasonable picture of the progression. High-pressure transmission across vast distances, boosted by part of its own volume at frequent intervals, filtered into metered buried networks that resemble the braided complexity of veins in human circulatory systems, all ending with a pair of extremely surmountable knobs on a cooktop inside the domestic barrier. How that doesn't explode at frightening statistical scale is the question of the safety mechanisms, right?
That is really where the engineering gets fascinating to me, Korn. The interesting part may be everything that must be assured at the boundary of not letting it explode levels. And to this point, we haven't even approached the concept of excess shutdown. But let me frame the question more sharply. Given that we're running explosive gas through millions of miles of steel pipe buried in corrosive soil, across seismic zones, under streets where construction crews might accidentally hit it, through areas that freeze and thaw and shift, given all of that, why isn't the failure rate higher? What are the layers of protection that make this system so remarkably safe in practice?
We haven't at all gotten into the detail. You know, I saw on a compendium that walked me through a disaster. You can probably take through the core of a high-profile case that captured part of the system in breakdown.
September 13, 2018, Merrimack Valley in Massachusetts. The Columbia Gas Company was doing a routine pipe replacement. A contractor incorrectly capped a sensor line that told pressure regulators the system wasn't overpressurized. That meant the regulators thought pressure coming from the transmission line was lower than it actually was, so they opened wider.
Which means what, exactly? In terms of gas flowing through a home's pipes, what's the physical experience inside someone's house when the regulators open wider because they've been lied to by a capped sensor?
The system pushed gas into distribution lines at pressures up to 12 times what the whole safety spec rated for dozens of neighborhoods. So imagine your stove, normally fed by gas at a quarter PSI, barely a whisper of pressure. Now imagine 12 times that for pushing gas through every connection, every joint, every valve in your home. Pilot lights that are supposed to be small blue flames become blowtorches. Gas forces its way past seals that were never designed to hold back that kind of pressure. It fills basements. It seeps through foundation cracks. One house ignited. In total, something like one death, 25 injuries, 8,000 evacuations, and thousands of structures stripped of plumbing and entirely rebuilt, quite literally, to code. First for gas delivery reinspected on a block-by-block red. The technical blame line came down to failed acknowledgement that pressure gauges were online but unread by the sensor array's work around.
a blind regulator. So, the high-pressure safety cascade, a whole line in that particular episode, happened to betray fundamental oversights about defaults and centralized monitoring. And what strikes me is that this wasn't a pipe failure in the traditional sense. Nothing corroded through, nothing was hit by a backhoe. It was an information failure. The physical infrastructure was intact. The logic layer failed.
Modern pipelines have to work by balancing four branches of protection, more than just backflow valves. One develops quickly for, but multiple isolation and routing patterns. Structural logic that makes a one-off in a low-frequency block feasible. Until things open unrestricted cross-traffic in main connections after under-pressure cycles, don't reset after contractor updates. Shifted all input draws linearly across all mains in Merrimack all at once.
That's a lot of detail. Let's pull back and talk about the layers that normally work, because Merrimack is the exception that proves the rule. What are the standard defenses?
And here's the first defense people really should appreciate. Pipelines are steel. You bury steel in wet soil for decades. Electrochemistry wants to turn it back into iron oxide. So you run a constant direct electrical current through them, sacrificial anodes plus insulated joints diverting oxidization from interior maintenance altogether. The pipe acts globally as an antimaterial cathode, never the donor metal. It basically swaps corrosion to some sacrificial substitute, very far's controlled price of connected release. Think of it as a lightning rod for rust. You give the corrosion something else to eat, something cheap and replaceable, and the pipeline itself remains untouched. It gives you 30 miles and improbable mitigation before midlife replacements in sequence. Years achieve partial returns with modern polymer additions for a smart grid fabric. Reinspect out in full bore underground that holds at year 50 while exposure at worst becomes natively inert before full block restructuring. It mitigates to natively hold the structural life cycle.
So the pipe is essentially wearing a sacrificial coat of armor that takes all the electrochemical damage. And you can monitor how much of that sacrificial material is left and replace it before the pipe itself is threatened.
SCADA systems are the beep pulse. Supervisory control and data acquisition. It's the nervous system of the pipeline network. A mechanism of collated master panel control connected with embedded sensors frequently poll that state. Open regional slide bar monitored sections that modify beyond key pressure gate classes alone. SCADA's alert pacing initiates sequence bleed. Drop control soon above minor bleeds until defined intervention measured against instantaneous comparison. Parameters across patterns generates monitored partial sleeve restoration across pressure regions rebalanced at demand loops. Essentially reorient valves dispreferentially to choke ruptures prior broadcast. Close containment finalized internally toward closure after local override assurance. Pre-instatement, a seal restoring full offline buffer. Recover states remotely from median pressure state between network thresholds within zone margins completed.
Is that always? Time to summary. The reading? In plain terms, SCADA is the system that watches everything and can close valves remotely before a human even knows there's a problem.
The effect stacks as if choking priority are automatically prioritized. If a pressure sensor detects a sudden drop, which indicates a rupture somewhere, the SCADA system can isolate that segment of pipe within seconds, closing valves upstream and downstream of the break. The gas in that segment vents, but the rest of the system continues operating normally. It's like a circuit breaker for gas pipelines.
It sounds laborious, but instinctual with program, reading practically synchronizing hazard map mesh protocol internally across built diagnostics. The speed is the thing. A computer can react to a pressure anomaly faster than any human operator could even notice the alarm.
Internal stage, main readings gate, it to remote manual oversight. Equivalent primary zone within minutes, draws area pressures to baseline. Vacant measures to prevent complete loop, bypass migration of exposure. Press consistent internal pressure along radial sequence closure around aperture region at all satellite interconnects that latch full. Vacant buffer states requiring controlled procedural reentry upon local ground. Walk recheck cleared boundary sweep and survey. Normative indication completed full sequence test. Ventilation leading recommission protocols. These loops normalize, restored status essentially filling void buffers from external bypass differentials, moving gas paths, re-examining distribution through static-controlled cascade sequences back to idle bias pressure, interlock sensor pairs adjusting for supply-side draw behind residual core load before comm remediation. The key point, after an automatic shutdown, you can't just flip a switch and turn everything back on. Someone has to physically walk the line, check every connection, verify that there's no accumulated gas in basements or vaults, and then follow a step-by-step repressurization procedure. The restart is deliberately slow and human-intensive.
Listeners probably realize at this point monitoring more than leakage means scanning for dynamic thresholds. It's not just, is there gas where there shouldn't be? It's, is the pressure curve doing something that doesn't match normal demand patterns?
The PHMSA regulation says the odorant must register identifiably down to below a fifth of explosive concentration ratings. The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration sets the standard. You have to be able to smell the gas before the concentration reaches a level where it could ignite. It actually is written this way, below a detection threshold inside the LEL boundary, so low it's no actual operative index, pre to really formal release proximity. The lower explosive limit for natural gas is about 5% concentration in air. The odorant has to be detectable at 1%, a 5-to-1 safety margin. That in time-distant read is absolutely after area purge tested in strict MathCal sensors, calibrated pre-evac verification anyway at real internal models, slower burn pattern ambient, register measured sometimes past multisensory negative hold confirmation for gas indicators in redundant sensors even in advanced computational detection, after which we still read under odor threshold significantly, and nobody considered ambient thresholds individually after survey any factor separate due safety.
Concrete smell plus automated mass shutdown in scope of catastrophic outcomes relinked building to static measures. So you've got the odorant as the biological warning system, and SCADA as the automated one. Two completely independent layers that don't rely on each other.
Commercially, it's relatively cheap what SCADA triggers simultaneous operations upon, fail-safe at structured active, by then protocols across hundreds of satellite interchanges coordinating val-seal capacity, dozens of even segmented networks beyond states mapping real-time constraints. Once isolate in configuration, shift standardized set of sequential normalized states from degraded entries marked for controller program block continuous if sequentially designated degraded. It triggers early human on and eventual role deployment fully designed off auto-diagnostic redundant forward control bypass layered toward field technician intervention before forward-based review mandatory handshake closing isolated sections. The cost of SCADA has dropped so much that even smaller municipal utilities can afford it now. What was once exotic is now standard.
An earthquake gate? Physical inertial shutoff? Physical mass disconnected from electronically active confirmatory reference sensor echo shutoff beyond cross-communicating with the independent main sensor position, detected seismic actuation baseline, that any major unmeted unpattern-like vector loss that could, even with near pre-information removal, completely shut urban conduit down for backup automated valve separation, completely shut urban conduit down for backup automated valve separation completion. You're describing seismic shoot-off valves that trigger mechanically when the ground shakes, independent of any electronic system. The shaking itself moves a physical mass that trips the valve closed. No power required, no signal required, no SCADA required.
That's the SEPRA parallel mechanism naturally fitted in California areas where massive subnet normally expected cascades stop before all services restored out serial checking before crew mobile schedules. Final reboot area with field cert equivalently slow zone isolation. Manually check beyond gas odor maps. No short immediate restarts but centralized priority open access list. Checked upstream till first post. Event services approval final, CERB city by panel, internal pilot, stat monitoring beyond minimal hazard indicator calibrated for close follow patrol sensor scan near aerial. Detect via drone-assisted confirmation unit dispatched round start physical seal after mapping certification fully discharged upstream via region command certification fully discharged. Most event times are measured seasonal forward limited release. After a major earthquake in a place like Los Angeles, the gas system stays down for days or weeks, not because the pipes are all broken, but because the restart protocol is deliberately cautious. Every segment gets walked. Every connection gets checked. The system trades speed of recovery for certainty of safety.
The record of protection schemes becomes essentially mitigates structural triggers. Cathodic protection handles corrosion. SCADA handles pressure anomalies. Seismic valves handle ground movement. Odorant handles the human nose. The absolute collapse. Scope single points compresses beneath extreme environments. Less prepared. See non-redundant full failure risk entirely shutting massive areas.
Compressor fail is linear plus scale exponential radial log under zero valve cushion. Metro supply grid regions fast exhibit brownout analog, known cold event feed loss extended. Blowback after sudden mainline surges earlier pressure, volume reball fed via nearby tie end, switching over via intermediate transient gas looping auxiliary forward, swaps after section command, pressure downsurge. Ultimately after several chaining runs refill starved subzone demand. Recovery, which absolutely within hours can initiate freeze. Caused burst events well removed on subscale leads tens miles far after compressor error, cascades met supply override protocol needed safely, by static regional hot spare before prior stored, remote surge, relief fail. A single compressor station going offline during a cold snap can cascade into a regional supply crisis because the pressure drops, flow slows, and downstream customers start pulling harder to compensate, which drops pressure further. It's a feedback loop that can empty the pipes faster than the remaining compressors can refill them.
Our per subnet collapses lower. The asymmetry equals centralized consequences, cascading blocks causing thermal distribution. Which brings us back to Daniel's original question about Israel. The fragmentation that looks primitive actually has a hidden safety advantage. Failure isolation is automatic because there's no interconnection to carry the failure from one building to the next.
In Israel context, neighbor's faulty propane fixture leaves that single apartment burn, sometimes penetrates maybe partial. Worst neighborhood result range. Restricted and entire separation units completely. Hermetic barrier structurally segmented permanently. Local zero indirect path, main loading bearing wall after immediate flameout barrier. Vault self-contained. The interconnected sieve scenario such faulty line failed. Mass pressure already opened. Sec ends prior valve. Scope unaffected full block radius, sometimes meter 60 buildings adjacent. Pair possibly heavily breached without wall barrier, reach cumulative threat multiple apiece. Structure connective surface not just above damage, open partial facade sharing. The grid gives you convenience and reliability, but it also gives you coupling. A problem anywhere can become a problem everywhere.
Concretized, it describes building level but effectively grid. Vulnerable. If controls missing or under time correct partial group failure across full check level, the asymmetry made certain with case Merrimack pressure gone undetected. A single contractor's mistake in capping a sensor line affected 8,600 customers across three towns. In Israel's fragmented model, that same mistake affects one building.
UK still contains cast iron main air lines. 19th century cast joined with lead yarn packing period installs. Cross period internal deposition layers require immense cost rebuilding on century pace, fully 100B roughly. Berlin parallel cost segments restructure. Decade. Similarly, US patch primarily post-war high-qual monitored steel. Newer most zone averages certainly mid-50s decades. The vast ongoing replacement bill ever deferred yet pipeline region tier segmented pattern. Different countries are sitting on different vintages of infrastructure, and the replacement costs are staggering. The UK's cast iron mains, some of them laid during the Victorian era, are reaching the end of their useful life all at roughly the same time. It's a £100 billion problem that someone has to pay for.
That frames increasing tenancy cut expansion outright. If you're facing a £100 billion replacement bill, you start asking whether you should replace the gas pipes at all, or whether you should just skip straight to electrification. Berkeley's First Ban 2019 leads. Calif coverage grew consecutive per city limit, some pattern red, else zero new connections overall. Extended nearly 100 cities, statewide partial various further states, enabling high limit further decline. Scaling elective building. Decisions fully new connected. Ban distribution. Main share in static non-connection. Reduce net new buildings. Decrease ratio. Significant to decrease projected overall region. Progressively toward on-model fixed rate shifted user. spread small residual prior formula, increasingly inevitable accelerated consumer...
That's the death spiral itself. More exit raises prices on remainders exactly as fixed pipeline. Retirement cost allocated. Limited shrinking base lifts bills boost permanent. Exit net across multi-year loop forward, completely diminishing served accounts progressively active. Migration toward all-electric early achieving decarbon plus comfort further damp. The math is brutal. If you have 1 million customers and they're all sharing the cost of maintaining 2 million miles of pipe, and then 100,000 of them switch to heat pumps and disconnect from the gas system entirely, the remaining 900,000 now have to cover the same fixed costs. Their bills go up. That makes heat pumps look even more attractive by comparison, so more people switch. The bills go up again. It's a feedback loop that, once it starts, is very hard to stop.
USA still heats 60% according partial data range, even newer decade, plus additional regional higher scale north despite prior about 100 partial acts installing zero net gas code. Though much southern service, warmer share small count overall building, count lower absolute effect upon aggregate. So the death spiral hasn't hit everywhere equally. The northern states with cold winters still have a massive residential gas heating base. Grid stable but direction set. Heavily regulatory urban relative, heavy uptake, large shares heating. Even colder metro, somewhat partial regional variation, especially prior winter thermal total, colder high electric penalty complex, offsetting payback far slower.
Heat pump parity now large fraction warming. Day middle peak non-peak basic close favorable multi-decade comparable measured standard zone. Medium already most multi-zone setups beating operational year, long average and almost generic comparative residential main zone, measure fine level total, 5-year actual track California. June 2026 base point, most West Geo averaging 2026 base point most West Geo averaging 25% discount against gas cycle. Whole retrofit load, very sharp slope decline, eventual across national partial regional, by period mid-lat decade pair, truly resolving lot favorable build cycles, catching with bait. The technology curve on heat pumps has been remarkable. 10 years ago, they struggled below freezing. Now, there are cold climate models that maintain full efficiency down to negative 15 Fahrenheit. The economic case is closing even in places like Minnesota and Maine.
Industrial still staying. Total residue span amid. Offset partial Fazadio offstat Prajing compound position, with states firmly high building large expand, terminal thereby worldwide multi-client decrease zone, offset partial net decline distribution, local likely two-speed long life base plateau, extending for resilient industrial plus LNG anchor, essentially across significant zone strongly yet domestic space, lock dependent, policy zone increasingly, conversion decreasing base load burners, eventually only thin grid halfback for store hide downstream, into large summary hydrogen cap test. Decade stretch potentially vastly, always infrastructure legacy redesign feasible next faceable. Industrial users aren't leaving gas the way residential users are. You can't run a glass furnace or a steel mill on a heat pump. The high temperature industrial processes, plus the LNG export terminals, will keep gas flowing through the transmission system for decades, even if every home in America disconnects. Many open pipeline questions, multi-decade side policy, accelerate, reverse all stops, flatten variable builds, enormous vast renewal projects, or closing digs unknown. Millions mile pipe total bury mass. Legacy replace question, enormous, ask sometimes repurposed, dime small CO back. Store set experimental pipe size current, unknown physical steady trial. Micro-inject clustered towards possible sink block. What do we do with 2 million miles of pipe when the gas stops flowing? Do we dig it up? Do we leave it in the ground? Do we repurpose it for something else? Hydrogen, carbon dioxide, something we haven't thought of yet.
Hard transition timelines, roughly 60 to 80 year full lifespan, pending choices, extremely slow RecNet tight series building pattern toward turn decades, somewhat, plus infrastructure renewal halfway grid, physically under complete eventually sequence. We're not going to wake up one day and find the gas system gone. It'll be a slow, uneven retreat. Some neighborhoods electrifying quickly, others holding on for decades, industrial users anchoring the transmission system, and eventually a rump network serving a shrinking customer base at ever higher prices until the economics simply don't work anymore. The last gas customer in America will probably pay an astronomical bill. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
A traditional Aleutian cooking vessel called the Chagadax was carved from a single piece of driftwood and sealed with sea lion oil. Capacity was measured by how many whole salmon could be packed inside rather than by volume. A typical household Chagadax held 8 to 12 salmon, roughly equivalent in use to a modern 4-gallon stockpot.
Equal volumetric yields with the addition of intense pinniped preservation. Perfect. There's something wonderful about a measurement system based on how many salmon. It's so directly tied to what actually matters, feeding your family, rather than an abstract unit like gallons or liters.
Measurement should probably have been extended calibrated versus heat loss to counter strong coastal drafts, but surprising degree actual home economic knowledge systematically expressed. These weren't just cooking vessels. They were engineered objects, optimized for a specific environment and a specific set of constraints. The driftwood material choice, the sea lion oil sealant, the salmon-based capacity measure. Every element reflects deep knowledge of the available resources and the actual use case.
This has been my weird prompts. Provided listener no main meter from utility perspective. No procedure guide. Probably sight. Under panel clear red schematic labeling side gauge to inside. Partial may be inside after multi-tool. Easily any user practice step record. Locate tag, easily valve flip internal quarter. Turn routine, horizontal to pipe, following this quick point. Immediate manual leak threshold. Inter N plus comfort handling. Likewise, good heat pump analysis. Local part rating fine. Install calculation. End decision strongly settle potentially. Year completion overall upgrading. Please circulate your friends. Episode cite my weird prompts full text plus share. Sloping forward and podcast apps. Spotify primarily works. Episode done at 30 min cap. Great. Production flawless. Vast good home. Appreciated future here. Sign on to mark reference. After pro. Close soon. Part close. Very completion.
Web, podcast, sub, everything. Install local forward research. Install podcast, etc. Standard apps, full series fill. Excellent. 1000. Thank you.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.